what Fritz's mission had been, find Goldschmidt.
There is no reason to wait, Otmar said.
He patted the suitcase.
We will do our job and be well on our way home to our reward when our science project here goes off.
My heart was thumping so hard, I was sure the other boys could hear it. My eyes flicked from the suitcase bomb to Otmar, to Erhard, to Fritz. I could beat each of them in a straight fight, but not all together, not all at once, not here. How was I going to stop them?
We go now, Otmar said. For Hitler!
For Hitler! The other boys cried. And the mission to assassinate Professor Hendrik Goldschmidt began before I could stop it. Coming Clean. Otmar and Erhard ran one way down the hall, and Fritz and I ran the other. Fritz carried the suitcase with our clothes in it.
Fritz, we can't do this, I told him. Dozens of innocent people will be killed. Hundreds. Hundreds of innocent people are killed all over Germany each night when the bombs fall, Fritz said. This is no different.
There was no changing his mind. No changing any of their minds. Fritz turned a corner. Instead of following him, I pulled up short and sprinted in the other direction, looking for a Swiss soldier. If Fritz noticed I wasn't behind him, he wouldn't stop. He had a schedule to keep. It felt like forever, but was probably just a minute or two before I found a Swiss soldier. I ran up to him out of breath and hurriedly tried to explain.
The boys I came with, they have a bomb. They're going to blow up the resort. You have to stop them.
It took another agonizingly long few minutes for the Swiss guard to confer with his lieutenant and for me to explain all over again.
It's in a suitcase. Two boys have it, I told them. I can show you where.
Finally, the soldiers let me lead them down the stairs to the basement. We caught Otmar and Erhard looking for a place to hide the suitcase among the stacked-up chairs and tables and storage crates. Otmar still had it in his hands.
There, that's it, I told the soldiers. The bomb's in that suitcase.
I was exposing myself now, letting Otmar and Erhard know I was a traitor in their midst. But it didn't matter. It was all going to be over soon. It was time to come clean. The soldiers pointed rifles at the boys, and Otmar and Erhard held up their hands. The Swiss lieutenant took the suitcase from them, set it gently on the floor, and flipped the latches. I flinched, worried the bomb might go off before its timer. The Swiss soldier lifted the lid slowly, carefully, and we all saw what was inside. A messy pile of clothing. A silly prank. The bomb wasn't in the suitcase. I shook my head and took a step back. But no, I had watched Otmar put the bomb in the suitcase. I'd seen him pick it up and take it with him. Had they doubled back and picked up one of the others? No, there wouldn't have been time. We'd left the room together, each of our teams with a suitcase. Understanding hit me like an avalanche. Fritz. Fritz and I had carried the suitcase with the bomb, not Otmar and Erhard. They'd known all along I was a traitor. They'd tricked me into revealing my hand, and now Fritz was somewhere loose in the hotel with a bomb. Otmar looked innocent.
I don't know what this is all about, he told the soldiers. Michael told us our rooms were in the basement, but there don't appear to be any guest rooms down here.
The Swiss lieutenant frowned at me.
A joke, then? Is that what this is? A silly prank? Send your friends down here looking for their room, and then drag us after them, telling us they're carrying a bomb?
A bomb?
Erhard said. He looked at me in horror.
Michael, a joke is a joke, but telling them they're carrying a bomb, and with a war going on, no less? No, I told the soldiers. They're lying. You don't understand.
We take bomb threats very seriously in this country, the lieutenant told me.
He took me by the arm.
There are penalties for making false alarms.
As if on cue, alarm bells rang throughout the resort. The Swiss soldiers looked up in a panic.
The avalanche warning, one of them said.
No, wait, I told them. This was part of the plan. It's a distraction.
The lieutenant ignored me. Avalanche alarms trumped boys who cried wolf any day.
Stay here, he told us. Don't leave this room. You're safe in this room.
The Swiss soldiers ran from the room, and suddenly I was alone with Otmar and Erhard. Otmar smiled wolfishly at me. Erhard cracked his knuckles. Otmar took a step toward me, fists clenched.
You heard what the man said, Michael. Don't leave the room. You're safe here.
Professor Hendrik Goldsmith. I ran for the door, but one of them grabbed me by the shirt and yanked me back. Otmar? Erhard? I swung as I turned, my fist glancing off somebody's cheekbone in the same moment one of them kicked me in the shin. Pain flared through me like a firebomb, but I couldn't think about it. A fist found my stomach, doubling me over. A knee found my face, knocking me back. I slammed into a stack of chairs 3 times as tall as me, the tower of seats swaying precariously as I clung to it, trying to stay on my feet. And suddenly I was back in that schoolyard in London again, remembering that if you fell down, it was over. I wiped my dripping nose. Otmar and Erhard grinned like hyenas and converged on me. Rage coursed through my veins. If Hitler wanted his youth to learn how to take a beating, I would give these 2 boys their final lesson. The same lesson I'd taught to Horst. No, I don't have time for this. The alarm was still going off. Any minute now, people would start flooding into this room, hiding out from an avalanche that wasn't coming. Fritz still had the suitcase bomb. He was the one I had to find, the one I had to stop. But Otmar and Erhard were standing in the way. I grabbed the swaying stack of chairs behind me and pulled. The tower came crashing down on the boys, knocking them aside. I bolted for the door and ran for the stairs. Guests were already streaming down them. They weren't stampeding, but they were moving quickly. Men in suits and ties, women in nice dresses, scientists and thinkers from around the Western world. I couldn't let these people die. The top of the stairs was crowded, and I was running the wrong way. A soldier tried to turn me around, but I slipped under his arm and charged ahead, running straight into a short, thin man with curly black hair and round glasses.
Professor Goldsmith? I said.
I recognized him from a photograph the science team had been shown.
Are you Professor Hendrik Goldsmith?
Yes, he said, surprised to be recognized.
The current of people took us back toward the stairs.
Professor Goldsmith, you have to come with me,
I told him. I tried to pull him away.
No, but the alarms, the avalanche, he said, pulling me with him.
We had each other by the arms, each tugging in the opposite direction.
You can't go down there, I told him. Your life is in danger. A group of boys have been sent from Germany to kill you.
A few of the people streaming around us for the basement turned to look at us when they heard that, but they didn't stop.
Kill me? But how? Why?
Because of your work.
I leaned in close and lowered my voice.
Because of your work on the atomic bomb.
Professor Goldsmith's eyes went wide. He pulled me out of the flow of traffic over to the wall, where we had a bit more privacy.
But, how can you know that?
Because the Nazis know it, I told him.
Gah, this was taking too long.
Look at me. Look at this uniform. I was on the team sent to kill you, but I'm Irish.
I switched to speaking English.
I'm a spy for the Allies. I was sent here to save you.
Goldsmith let me pull him along away from the basement as he struggled to understand.
But you're just a boy.
My father is the Irish ambassador to Germany, I told him. Was the Irish ambassador. We found out too late to tell anyone else. They had to send me.
But this is...
This is incredible.
Goldsmith stopped in an empty hallway next to a table with a vase full of Edelweiss flowers.
Switzerland is neutral.
Do you think the Nazis care? I asked him.
As if to prove my point, Otmar jumped us from behind. Dreams of Metals. Otmar threw himself at Goldsmith with a roar. He drove the professor into the table, knocking him and the vase to the carpet. Otmar raised his dagger to plunge it into Goldsmith's heart, but I tackled him first. We tumbled head over heels, kicking and punching and scrabbling for control of his dagger. Otmar ended up on top of me, his dagger pointed at my throat. I pushed back with one hand and groped beside me with the other. I felt the knife tip nick my throat, felt the warm trickle of blood run down the side of my neck, and then my free hand found it, the flower vase. I whipped it up into the side of Otmar's head, shattering it. It rang with a high, hollow clang like a church bell, and Otmar crashed into the wall, unconscious. It wasn't a lost limb, but maybe there was a medal you could get for brain damage. Professor Goldsmith helped me to my feet and gave me a handkerchief to stop the bleeding on my neck.
Do you believe me now? I asked him.
He nodded emphatically. I grabbed his arm and pulled him along. Forget Fritz and the bomb. If I could get Goldsmith out of here, Fritz wouldn't blow the place up. Not when Earhart told him Goldsmith wasn't in the basement. Goldsmith was the mission. They could blow this resort to kingdom come, but they couldn't come back to Germany if they didn't blow up Goldsmith with it.
Wait, Goldsmith said, pulling me to a stop. What now?
They have to find Otto Strassmann, Goldsmith said. He's an Austrian physicist. He's why I'm here. I'm supposed to recruit him for the Manhattan Project and take him with me back to the United States.
I couldn't believe this guy. Did you not see Otmar try to kill you just now? Who's more important, you or this Strassmann guy?
Goldsmith straightened his glasses.
Well, Strassmann's done excellent work on the thermodynamics of superconductors, but I was the one who first proposed the idea of electron spin.
I had no idea what he was talking about.
You win, I told him. You can try and recruit him another time when somebody isn't trying to kill you. I grabbed Goldsmith by the sleeve and pulled him along. I kept my eyes peeled for Fritz as we ran for the lobby of the resort, but he wasn't anywhere. I hauled Goldsmith out the front door and headed for the cable car. Goldsmith looked worriedly up at the snow-capped mountain behind the resort.
But what about the avalanche?
There isn't an avalanche, I told him. That was just to get everybody into the basement so they could blow you up with a bomb.
Good God, Goldsmith said.
Yeah, I said. Wait here.
I ran for the place where I'd tucked the plans for Project 1065. I was getting out of here with Goldsmith and the jet fighter plans. I was going to get more medals than Otmar and Earhart could even dream about. I was just imagining Winston Churchill, the British Prime Minister, pinning the Victoria Cross on my shirt when I pulled the stone from the wall and froze. The Project 1065 plans were gone.
Mad as hell. The hole was empty. I checked again. Had I found the wrong stone? No. This was the right place. This was the right stone. The jet fighter plans were gone. But how? If the stone had fallen out and the plans had blown away, the stone would be on the ground, not stuck back in the hole. Which meant someone had come along behind me, pulled out the stone, taken the plans, and put the stone back where I'd left it. And there was only one person I could think of who'd done it. Fritz. He had seen me pull the plans out of my shirt. That's what he'd been talking to Otmar about in the lobby of the resort. Otmar might have sent him out to look for Goldsmith, but he'd also sent him to see what I'd stuck in the wall. My heart sank. They'd known since we left our hotel room that I was a traitor. That's how Otmar had known to switch suitcases.
to send the bomb with Fritz. They knew I'd lose Fritz as soon as I could run and tell on Otmar and Erhard, while Fritz ran free to finish the assassination. An icy chill swept through me. Fritz knew I'd betrayed him. Not just today, but all along. When he looked at what I'd hidden in the wall, he would have known at once what they were. He would know why I'd come over to his house all those times, why I'd joined the SRD with him, why I'd pretended to be his friend. He would know it was all to steal the jet fighter plans out from under his nose and hand them over to the Allies. Fritz was still out there with the bomb, and he was mad as hell. "We have to get out of here," I told Goldschmidt, pushing him toward the cable car station. "Now!" Another tram was just reaching the station. A few people were on it, and we pushed past them to get on board. I caught a glimpse of the long, long drop down the mountainside as I put Goldschmidt in a seat, and I almost blacked out right then and there. It was only the adrenaline coursing through my system that kept me awake. I grabbed for one of the hand straps that hung from the ceiling and wrapped myself around one of the poles. I wanted to close my eyes, to sink to the floor and pass out, but I couldn't. Fritz might come running for the tram any second now, suitcase bomb in hand. I had to protect Goldschmidt, had to get him to safety. Eyes fluttering, I unsnapped the Hitler Youth dagger on my belt and hugged the pole, willing myself to stay awake, to stay on my feet. When you fell down, it was over.
"Did you hear the one about the Englishman, the Irishman, and the Scotsman who were all staying at the world's tallest hotel?" I asked Goldschmidt without turning around.
No, I can't say I have," Goldschmidt said.
The glass doors to the tram slid shut, and the cable car moved away from the station. We'd made it.
"I'll tell you later," I said, and I gave in and slumped to the ground at last.
Something big and heavy thumped on the roof of the cable car, and I jerked awake. The metal blade of a dagger was sticking through the roof, keeping whoever had jabbed it there from sliding off the top of the car. The dagger had words on it. From where I sat, pooled helplessly on the floor, I could read them. Blood and honor. Fritz was on the roof of the cable car. For the glory of old Ireland. A brown suitcase dipped below the edge of the roof. I could see it through the window. Fritz's head peeked through the window upside down. He saw me, saw Professor Goldschmidt, and then he and the suitcase disappeared again. Fritz was on the roof of the cable car, and he had the suitcase bomb. He had waited for us. He knew I'd go for Professor Goldschmidt and try to get him out of the resort. Fritz had waited for us on top of the cable car station, watched us get on board, separated us from the others so he could kill us. Professor Goldschmidt stood and went to the window, trying to see up top.
"What's going on? Who's that boy?"
He's one of the ones sent to kill you," I said.
I closed my eyes and fought off my nausea. I wished Goldschmidt would sit down. He was making the cabin rock.
"His name is Fritz. He has a bomb. A bomb? But if he blows us up, he'll die too."
"He doesn't care," I told him. "He was born to die for Germany." I'd said it sarcastically, but I realized suddenly that it was true. Fritz believed all that stuff about sacrificing himself for the fatherland, for Hitler. He would do it. He would fulfill the Hitler Youth motto: live faithfully, fight bravely, and die laughing. Goldschmidt fretted around the cabin like a caged chicken.
"But we're trapped in here. It's a 40-minute ride to the bottom."
And the bomb had a 15-minute timer. I knew the score. We were in trouble. We were going to die.
"We have to get up there," Goldschmidt said. "We have to stop him. He'll blow us all up."
I nodded. He was right. But I couldn't be the one to do it. Goldschmidt didn't wait for me to help him. He tried the doors first, but those were locked tight, of course. They didn't want anybody accidentally opening them and falling to their death. He tried the windows next and managed to get one of them open. He did all this while I lay curled around one of the poles in the middle of the cabin, fighting desperately not to black out.
"I opened a window, but I can't fit," Goldsmith said. "You could, though."
I would have laughed if I wasn't afraid I would throw up.
"I'll fall. I'll die," I told him. "Young man, listen to me," Goldsmith said. "He has a bomb, and if he's as crazy as you say he is, he'll use it. One way or another, you're going to die. We both are. Wouldn't you rather die fighting?"
"I'm such a good driver. I stay as far away from cliffs as I can," I told him, remembering my joke. Goldsmith didn't understand, but I knew Simon would. And I also knew Simon would be telling me to get up, to confront my fear. Simon had died fighting rather than be led quietly to his death, and he'd want me to do the same. I pulled myself up the pole to my knees. I kept my eyes on the floor. "Did you hear the one about the Englishman, the Irishman, the Scotsman, and the Welshman who were riding in a hot air balloon?"
"I know," Goldsmith said. "Is this really a time for jokes?"
I pulled myself to my feet. "The balloon was about to crash into a mountain," I went on. "So the pilot says to them, 'We need to lose more weight to get clear. One of you has to jump.'" I took a step across the cabin, going from one pole to the other. "So the Scotsman, he says, 'I do this for the glory of Scotland.' And he jumps out of the basket." I let go of the pole and grabbed hold of the window. Goldsmith was right. It was just big enough for me to climb through. Outside, a white and brown mountain peak sailed by. The tram rumbled as it went over one of the pylons that supported the cable, and I swallowed hard.
"But the balloon wasn't high enough yet. 'We need to lose more weight,' the pilot says. 'So the Welshman says, I do this for the glory of Wales,' and jumps out of the balloon to his death."
"I don't understand how any of this," Goldsmith started to say, but I held up a hand to quiet him.
I steadied my breathing and stepped up onto the bench below the window.
"We need to lose the weight of just one more person, and we'll make it, the pilot says."
I reached outside the window, felt the cold mountain air humming by, found a ledge on the roof to pull myself up on. "So the Irishman, he says, 'I do this for the glory of old Ireland.' And he picks up the Englishman and throws him over the side." I looked back at Goldsmith. He was frowning as though he didn't understand. "For the glory of old Ireland," I said, and I hauled myself up and out the window.
Don't look down. Wind whipped my hair into my face. The metal ledge of the roof was cold and hard under my fingers, bit into my skin. I worked my feet onto the windowsill and raised my head. I couldn't see the roof because I had my eyes squeezed shut. I should probably open them at some point if I plan on actually climbing on top of the cable car, I realized. But right then, I was just fine with them closed. I was just fine standing here on top of the window, not looking. But I didn't have time for this. Fritz was up there with a bomb.
Did you hear the one about? I couldn't do it. Couldn't focus. I lost control of my breathing. Started hyperventilating. If I didn't move soon, I was going to fall. I was going to fall, and Fritz was going to blow Professor Goldsmith into the atoms he liked to study.
"You have to open your eyes, Michael. There's no other way to do it."
I opened my eyes. All I saw was the white-painted top of the aerial tram, curving up and away from me, blue sky beyond. Good. This was good. I could do this. "Just don't look down," I told myself. "Don't look down.
Don't look down. I looked down. Fir trees, giant fir trees, and the tops of them were far below me. I could see all the way down them, all the way to the snowy forest floor. The earth shrank away from me and came screaming at me at the same time. My brain detached from the rest of my body, floated away, and I was outside myself again, watching my body go slack, watching my hands let go, watching my feet slide off the windowsill, watching myself fall. Might makes right. A hand grabbed mine, held on like a pit bull, pulled me up over the edge until I lay dazed and addled in the middle of the cable car's roof, Fritz panting beside me. Fritz! Fritz had saved me from falling.
That's two, Fritz said.
Two times he had saved me from falling. Two times he had saved my life.
Why do I keep saving you? Fritz asked me.
I wondered the same thing. The metal roof under me made my skin crawl. Or maybe it was how exposed I was up here on the roof. The wind, a living thing that pushed at me, nudged me, trying to throw off my balance, trying to push me over the side. When you fell down, it was over. I dragged myself to the arm that connected the center of the roof to the thick metal cables higher above us. It was too big to wrap my arms around, but I put my back to it, taking a little shelter from the wind. Fritz stood in the middle of the roof, the wind pushing and pulling at his clothes. The suitcase lay on its side between his feet. He looked like Hitler's man-god up here, Zeus standing atop Mount Olympus, a lightning bolt in his hand. Right at this moment, Fritz ruled the world, the only world that mattered to the two of us.
I'm impressed, Fritz said. I know how hard it was for you to do that. You're learning to overcome your fear. That's good.
That which doesn't destroy us, I said, my voice weak, almost carried away on the wind.
Makes us stronger. Yes, Fritz said.
The cable car rumbled past another pylon, and Fritz rode the lurching tram like an old sailor standing his ground in a storm.
You did that for me, Michael. You made me stronger. You taught me how to fight back. Maybe that's why I keep saving you, because you saved me.
Made you into a monster, you mean?
Fritz frowned.
Is the wolf a monster for eating the rabbit? Is a hawk a monster for eating the mouse? All life is struggle, Michael. He who wants to live should fight for himself. He who doesn't fight doesn't deserve to live.
Might makes right, I said.
Yes, exactly, Fritz said. This is the law of nature. This is why Germany will win.
Slowly, I felt myself coming back to life. Felt my arms and legs and head as though they were all attached to my brain again, not separate things floating away from each other. My chest still heaved from the panic of falling, but it was settling down, slowing. I had to get control. I had to be here for this. As wrong as Fritz was about everything else, he was right about one thing. If I didn't fight for myself now, I wasn't going to live.
Fritz, listen to me. You're not a monster. I know it. That's why you separated us from the rest of the guests at the resort. So you wouldn't kill all those innocent people. You don't have to kill Professor Goldschmidt. You don't have to kill me. You don't have to kill yourself. There's another way out of all this. You don't have to start that timer.
Oh, I'm sorry, Michael. I don't think you understand, Fritz said.
I already did.
The New Michael. My body sank. If Fritz had already started the timer, we had only minutes left, maybe seconds. How long ago had he turned it on? How long had it taken me to climb out that window, for him to pull me up on the roof? How long had I been lying here just talking to him? I had to do something.
I should be mad at you, you know,
Fritz said calmly, as if he hadn't just told me the bomb between his feet was ticking down to our deaths. He pulled a packet of papers from inside his shirt and held them up for me to see. The plans for Project 1065.
All that time, you weren't really my friend, Fritz said. You were just using me.
It was like that at first, I told him. But I really did become your friend. I still am.
Fritz shook his head.
No, you're not my friend.
He waved the jet fighter plans at me.
You're the enemy, and I beat you.
Fritz ripped the packet of papers open, and the wind tore them away. They disappeared over the side, lost forever in the alpine forest below. All that work, gone with the wind. The gaping pit in my stomach grew wider. Now the Allies would never match the Germans in the air. The war would end before Goldschmidt or anybody else could build an atomic bomb.
I should be mad at you, but I'm not, Fritz said. I respect you for what you did. You're fighting for what you believe in. There's honor in that, even if you're wrong. There's honor in kicking that suitcase over the side, too, I told him. There's honor in a fair fight, in not killing your enemies when they can't fight back, not murdering them.
Fritz smiled and spread his arms wide, swaying a little in the wind.
If you want to kick this suitcase over the side, come do it.
He was teasing me. He knew I wouldn't do it, knew I couldn't do it. He was just going to stand there taunting me until the bomb went off because my fear of heights had paralyzed me. But that was the old Michael, the Michael who thought all this was a game. This was the Michael who knew it was real. I pulled myself up on the arm of the cable car, drew my Hitler Youth dagger from its sheath, and took a step toward him, ready to fight. Shunk. The look of easy victory on Fritz's face faltered. He hadn't expected me to actually get up. He took a frightened step back, then remembered we were on top of a cable car. He did the German look over his shoulder to get his bearings, planted his feet again, and drew his dagger. With his other hand, he picked up the suitcase with the bomb in it. He wasn't just going to let me kick it off the roof. If I wanted to throw it over the side, I was going to have to take it from him. Fine. Then that's what I would do. The tram rumbled onto another one of the support pylons, and I used that moment to charge him. I swiped at him with my dagger. He jerked back out of the way and threw the suitcase in between us like a shield. The suitcase was heavy, though, too heavy to hold up for long. His arm dropped, and in the opening I gave him a quick jab with my left fist, punching him square in the nose. He staggered a step back and dropped his dagger. It rattled across the rooftop and fell over the side. Fritz's eyes filled with fear. I'd taught him how to fight, but he still wasn't good enough to beat me. I lunged at him with a dagger. He threw the suitcase up again, holding it with both hands. Shunk! My dagger sank 4 inches into the suitcase, slicing right through the leather case and into the machinery inside. We froze. Me still holding the knife, Fritz still holding the suitcase, waiting for the bomb to explode. It didn't. Thum. Time unfroze. I yanked the knife out, and Fritz reared back with the suitcase to knock me off my feet. Fritz swung, I swung. I ducked, Fritz didn't. The dagger caught him in the arm, tearing a long gash through fabric and skin. Blood sprayed from the tip of my dagger as it cut clean through, and Fritz screamed and clapped a hand to his arm. The hand that had been holding the suitcase. It clattered to the roof, slid down the curve, and caught on the ledge. Fritz and I gave each other the same startled look, then dove for the suitcase at the same time. We hit the roof with a thump, and the suitcase bounced over the side and plummeted into the snowpack far below.
No! No!
Fritz screamed. He turned and started beating wildly on me with his fists the way he had the first day he'd fought back in the classroom, not really hurting me so much as disorienting me. I dropped my dagger, and Fritz snatched it up before it slid away. He climbed to his feet.
I'll just climb down there and kill him myself, Fritz told me. You can come after me if you want, but this time I'm not going to save you when you fall. Thoom!
The suitcase bomb detonated far below us, the shockwaves so strong I could feel them all the way up here. It didn't do anything but surprise us, sober us, or so we thought. At first, it sounded like thunder, like the creaking of a metal swing on the playground. Then it turned into a low rumble, like a plane flying high overhead. And then 10 planes, and then 100 planes. And then a waterfall, a never-ending torrent. And then we saw what it was. The explosion had triggered an avalanche. Avalanche. Fritz and I watched, transfixed, as snow roared down the side of the mountain toward the forest of fir trees below, toward us. At first, I couldn't believe it would possibly reach us, but as the snow rolled down the mountain, giant clouds of it blossomed and roiled, growing bigger and taller. The avalanche was going to hit the cable car. I rolled for the arm at the center of the roof, wrapping my whole body around it just as the first snowburst hit us. The snow stung like sleet, and then the bigger clouds caught us. Snow and rocks slammed into me like gravel fired from a cannon. I heard Fritz cry out, but couldn't see him in the storm. I clung to the arm of the cable car and held on as the tram was knocked sideways, sweeping up and away from the avalanche like a flag in the wind. The snow pummeled me, beat me like waves, trying to strip me free, but I held on. And then it was past. The tidal wave of snow rumbled on down the mountain. The aerial tram swung sickeningly back down to how it was supposed to hang, and I sucked in a desperate lungful of air, snow and ice still covering every inch of my body. I had hung on, but Fritz hadn't. I was alone on the roof of the cable car. When you fell down, it was over. Untouched by war. The train compartment rocked like the cable car swinging in the sky, but this one was mercifully connected to the ground. I slumped heavily against the window, still stunned that I had been able to save Professor Goldschmidt, who sat on the seat across from me. Still stunned that I had fought Fritz on top of a cable car, that I had watched him there, clinging to the roof of the gondola one moment, gone the next. Goldschmidt and I had caught a train from Murin to Bern, the capital of Switzerland, where there was an Irish embassy just like the one in Berlin. Only this one, presumably, still had an ambassador. Once I handed over Goldschmidt, he wasn't my responsibility anymore. Our train rumbled along the sweeping curve of a stone bridge, a lazy crystal blue river below us. Enormous evergreen trees stood like sentinels along hillsides covered in a soft white blanket of snow. A little village with peaked roofs, a church steeple, and smoking chimneys glowed yellow-orange in the fading twilight. This was a Europe untouched by war. This was a Europe where no bombs had fallen. No Jews had been rounded up and sent to concentration camps. No tanks had torn the streets up with their treads. Where homes and churches and schools still stood. Where food was plentiful. Where people still greeted one another warmly on the sidewalk without suspicion. This was Switzerland, protected from the horrors on their doorstep by the thin shield of neutrality, the paper wall of diplomacy and politics, just like Ireland. But the war that was being fought just outside the borders of Switzerland and just across the Celtic Sea from Ireland wasn't just a war between the Axis and the Allies. It was a world war, and the fate of every nation on Earth, neutral or not, lay in the balance. When the war was over, the world would be ruled one way or the other, by freedom or fascism, by hope or by fear. I had seen the depths, the lengths the Nazis would go to win that war, sacrificing their own children to the cause. And I also knew firsthand the sacrifices the Allies had made to stop them.
I wonder, Michael, did you ever hear the one about the Englishman, the Irishman, and the Scotsman who were all lined up in front of a firing squad?
Whether they wanted them to or not, Simon and the Allies were fighting to save the world for Switzerland, too, and Ireland. What right did the Swiss, the Irish, the Spanish, anyone, have to sit out the fight for the fate of the world when they too would live or die by the result? A good man died to save you, I said to Goldschmidt, startling him. They were the first words either of us had spoken since we boarded the train, weary from our adventure. My voice sounded harder than I'd meant it to, like an accusation.
I didn't ask him to, Goldschmidt said defensively.
Well, he did, whether you wanted him to or not.
I'm sorry, Goldschmidt said.
Don't be sorry, I told him. Just make that bomb. Save the world. Do something that makes your life worth saving. Goldschmidt took off his glasses, cleaned them with his handkerchief, and put them back on.
I'll do my best, he said.
I stared out the window again at the white mountains in the distance. I thought of Simon and of my parents. Where were they right now? In a barn in Germany? Hiding beneath a bridge in Nazi-occupied France? Or had they gone north into Denmark, looking for a ferry to take them across the North Sea to England? Surely they hadn't gone east toward the Russian front. Wherever they were, I prayed they were safe and that I would see them again soon. Our train pulled into Bern less than an hour later. The station agent gave us directions, and the professor and I made our way to the Irish embassy. I spent more than a minute explaining to the lady at the front desk who Goldschmidt and I were and why we were there before I realized I was still speaking German and had to start all over again in English.
Yes, yes, Michael, the woman said. You've been expected.
I have, I asked.
We have? By whom?
But the lady was already on the phone, excitedly reporting our arrival. I heard a familiar voice give a happy cry somewhere down the hall. And then, my mother and father and I were running to meet each other, wrapping one another in one great Irish hug. An Englishman, a Scotsman, and an Irishman.
That should be the last of them, then,
Chief Technician Ross of the Royal Air Force said in his Scottish brogue. He shuffled the papers into a single stack and put his pencil and eraser on top of them. The pencil was blue and had Venus, blue band, super thin, 3561, number 2, printed on it in white. The eraser said W. H. Smith. I assumed it once said W. H. Smith, but the second H had worn off.
You've an absolutely incredible memory for detail, said Agent Faulkner.
He was in the SOE, Special Operations Executive, Britain's secret war intelligence organization, and a ramrod English aristocrat to the core. He was probably Lord something or other outside the war, and had gone to university at Oxford or Cambridge, or both.
I doubt even I could have reconstructed those plans from memory after all this time, he said.
After our happy reunion, my parents and I had flown under cover of night from Bern to London, where we were now. While my parents had spent the last 3 days being debriefed by the SOE and receiving their new orders from Dublin, I had worked with Chief Technician Ross to rebuild the plans for Project 1065 from memory, exactly the same way Simon and I had in the little secret room at the Irish Embassy. It hadn't been easy, but I'd already done it once in Berlin. Why couldn't I do it again here? Now, if the Nazis did build their jet-powered Flugzeug, fly thing, the German word for airplane, the Allies would have one to match them. Have you ever heard the one about the Englishman, the Irishman, and a Scotsman who sold their brains as transplants? I asked Agent Faulkner. The British intelligence officer looked a little taken aback. He glanced at the Scottish engineer, who just shook his head and smiled.
I'm afraid I haven't, said Agent Faulkner.
Well, it turns out the Irishman's and the Scotsman's brains only sold for £100, but the Englishman's sold for £5,000. It just goes to prove, said the Englishman, that Englishmen are much cleverer than Irishmen or Scotsmen. No, it doesn't, said the Irishman. It just means the Englishman's brain had never been used.
Right, Agent Faulkner said, not quite sure what to do with that.
Chief Technician Ross tried to hide a smile. Agent Faulkner stood.
I think we're about finished here, Chief Technician.
The Scotsman gave me an easy salute and collected the papers.
Cheers, lad.
I joked, but the whole reason I'd been able to remember the plans was down to Simon, my English friend. He was the one who'd helped me hone my memory, the one who'd played Kim's game with me night after night. He was the reason, too, that I'd been able to save Professor Goldsmith from Fritz. Fritz. I thought of him again, standing over me, that bloody Hitler Youth dagger in his hands, ready to die for Germany. He had, in the end. Like the Hitler Youth's motto, he'd lived faithfully and fought bravely, but he hadn't died laughing.
I understand you and your family are off to Washington, D.C. now, Agent Faulkner said when Ross was gone.
I nodded. We were going to America. It's a new posting for my father, I said. He reckons it'll be safer there than in Berlin, and Ma is going to help the Yanks with their new intelligence service. I paused, then asked, What about Professor Goldsmith? Is he back in the States working on the atomic bomb? Agent Faulkner cleared his throat.
I really couldn't say.
Of course not. Loose lips sink ships and all that. So when do I get to meet Mr. Churchill? I asked. Agent Faulkner looked bewildered.
Meet Mr. Churchill?
You know, to get my medal. Get my picture in all the papers. Faulkner looked uncomfortable.
You and your family may yet get a commendation from His Majesty's government, Agent Faulkner said. That's not for me to say. But, Michael, you do understand that you can't say a word about any of this, ever, to anyone.
I frowned. What? What do you mean I can't tell anyone? Agent Faulkner sat back down across from me.
Michael, it's imperative that you tell no one about what you and your parents have done. Not one bit of it. If you go telling your story, it will be obvious that we've had Irish agents working under Hitler's nose the whole war. That we still do have Irish agents in the field.
What's wrong with that? I asked. People should know.
Michael, it's vital that we maintain the illusion of Ireland's neutrality. It may yet be valuable to us. I'm afraid everything you've seen and heard, everything you and your parents have done for the war effort, falls under the Official Secrets Act. You're forbidden from telling anyone what happened, under penalty of imprisonment.
I couldn't believe it. My mother and father had been sending valuable intelligence to the Allies for years. I had just risked my life and theirs and sacrificed Simon's life to get the plans for Project 1065, to save Professor Goldsmith. And now we couldn't tell anybody about it? It's not fair, I told Faulkner.
Welcome to the world of international espionage, Agent Faulkner said, and he got up to leave.
He stopped and gave me a sympathetic look.
I'm afraid you'll just have to sleep well in the knowledge that you and your family have done your part to win the war.
I huffed. It wasn't enough. I wanted the world to know what I'd done, what Ma and Da had done. But then I remembered riding on the train through Switzerland with Goldschmidt, feeling bitter about Ireland's neutrality in the war. The truth was, Ireland wasn't sitting on the sidelines. We had done something. We were just fighting in a different way. Even though nobody would ever know what I'd done, what my Ma and Da had done, what Ireland had done, we'd stood up to Hitler and the Nazis with the rest of the Allies. We'd fought for freedom, too. Author's note. In modern history, young people were perhaps never used so much to fight a war as they were in Nazi Germany during World War II. At the beginning of the war, when things were going well for the Nazis, German children worked on the home front. Like their Allied counterparts in England and America and Russia, they were farmers, messengers, and air raid wardens. They collected raw materials in scrap drives. They put out fires and cleared debris after bombings. They worked in factories and hospitals and welfare agencies. But after the disastrous Battle of Stalingrad in early 1943, in which the Nazis lost more than 285,000 men, Germany became desperate for new soldiers. By that summer, Nazi Germany was officially drafting boys as young as 16 for active military duty. They were given guns, grenades, and rocket launchers, and sent to the front lines with little or no training. Tens of thousands of young German boys died fighting on the Russian front alone. In one extraordinary case, the Nazis created a special, fully equipped tank division manned entirely by Hitler youth between the ages of 16 and 18, and tasked them with stopping the Allied advance in France after D-Day. Of the more than 20,000 boys in the unit, almost half died in the war. In late 1944, when Germany's defeat was all but certain, Adolf Hitler ordered that every male between the ages of 15 and 60 who was not already fighting must join in the defense of Germany. But in reality, boys and girls as young as 11 years old were recruited to fight. The boys were given rocket launchers and grenades and sent to attack Allied tanks. The girls were taught to operate anti-aircraft guns and told to shoot down enemy planes. During the battle for the city of Aachen, American soldiers reported capturing German soldiers as young as 8 years old. Though unskilled, the German children fought with a ferociousness that frightened Allied troops. The Nazis had told their young soldiers that the Allies were monsters who would torture and kill them if they were captured, so many of them fought to the death or committed suicide rather than surrender. Of the 5,000 Hitler youths who fought in the Battle of Berlin at the end of the war, only 500 survived. In Adolf Hitler's last public appearance in April of 1945, he emerged from his bunker underneath what was left of the Reich Chancellery building to award the Iron Cross, Nazi Germany's highest honor, to members of the Hitler Youth who had showed bravery on the battlefield. The youngest of them was 12 years old. Hitler committed suicide just 10 days later, and within a week, Nazi Germany surrendered. But not before it had sacrificed an entire generation of young people to a mad dream of world domination. After the war, when the Allies had to decide which Nazis to try for war crimes, the Hitler youth who survived were forgiven because they were children. They had been misguided by their leaders, the Allies decided, who were really to blame. As a part of the denazification of Germany, the Allies showed films of the Nazi death camps to German children who had been members of the Hitler Youth and the Bund Deutscher Mädel. Many of them didn't believe the images they saw. They had been so brainwashed by their Nazi leaders that it took years for them to understand that they, and not the Allies, were the monsters. In the years to come, the boys and girls who had been members of the Hitler Youth came to despise Nazi Germany for turning them into soldiers, making them complicit in the Holocaust, and robbing them of their youth. Project 1065 is a work of fiction set against the very real backdrop of Nazi Germany in World War II. Kristallnacht, the Gestapo, the SRD, the concentration camps, the Hitler Youth, the Edelweiss pirates, the Aryan education in German schools. All of that is real. Everything Adolf Hitler says to Michael and the other boys in this book is an actual quote from Hitler. I gathered them together from various speeches and interviews so that I wasn't putting words in Hitler's mouth. Adolf Hitler said enough crazy, awful things that I didn't need to make up anything new for him. By 1943, the Americans and British were taking turns bombing Berlin, dropping more than 68,000 tons of bombs on the city, and many Allied bomber and fighter pilots had to parachute into enemy territory when their planes were shot out from under them. Some survived and were ferreted to safety by the resistance movement. Far more were captured and taken to concentration camps or killed. Nazi children were encouraged to spy on their parents and turn them in for violations, which they often did. The Nazis were great burners of degenerate books, too. But by 1943, when my story takes place, there weren't many large-scale book burnings anymore, mostly because the Nazis had already rounded up and destroyed all the books they disagreed with. Ireland was officially neutral during World War II, much to the disappointment and disdain of England and the rest of the Allies. The Irish did have an embassy in Berlin during World War II, but Michael and his family are fictional characters. The spying that the O'Shaughnessy family does, however, is based in reality. In the 1980s, declassified documents revealed that the Irish diplomatic corps in Europe had been actively collecting intelligence and sending it back to the Allies, at great risk to themselves throughout World War II. Though her army never fought in the war, Ireland, it turns out, wasn't quite as neutral as everyone had been led to believe. REAL 2 is Project 1065, the actual code name for the secret Nazi project to develop a jet-powered aircraft. In 1944, the Germans succeeded, and the Messerschmitt ME-262 Schwalbe became the world's first operational jet fighter, flying almost 100 miles an hour faster than any Allied plane in the skies. By then it was too little too late, but their invention of the jet engine did change the world. At the end of the war, the Allies snatched up the technology and developed jet planes of their own, and by the 1950s, jet planes began replacing propeller-powered planes in air forces and civilian air travel. Operation Paperclip, the code name for the real Allied plan to recruit or kidnap Nazi scientists to work for the United States, came a little later than I have used it here. But both the Americans and Russians played a chess game with scientists throughout the war, trying to capture the best brains in Europe for themselves. Both sides were particularly interested in rocket scientists for the coming space race, and in nuclear physicists who could develop an atomic bomb. The Manhattan Project, the code name for the U.S. project that created the world's first nuclear weapon, was a much bigger secret than I have made it here. Most people didn't know anything about the development of the atomic bomb until the United States became the first and only nation to use one, dropping atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, Japan in 1945. If you're looking to read more about Nazi Germany and the Hitler Youth, I highly recommend Susan Campbell Bertoletti's award-winning book, Hitler Youth, Growing Up in Hitler's Shadow, which follows 12 different young people growing up in Nazi Germany before and during the war. It was an invaluable resource to me in writing Project 1065.
This is Dan Bittner. We hope that you have enjoyed this production of Project 1065 by Alan Gratz. This program was produced and directed by Robert Kessler, executive producer Paul R. Gagne. Original music by Robert Kessler and Ethan Newberg. Print edition published by Scholastic Press, an imprint of Scholastic Inc. Text copyright 2016 by Alan Gratz. Production copyright 2016 by Scholastic Inc. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.